Welcome. This is Native Son on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I am your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Articles today come from Native News Online and the Arizona Republic. Up first, Chickasaw artists represent at Southwestern Association for Indian Arts in Santa Fe, by Chickasaw National Media. This year, six Chickasaw artists attended the Southwestern Association for Indian Arts, SWAIA, annual Santa Fe Indian Market in August. SWAIA is the largest juried first American art show in the world, with more than 100,000 people in attendance annually. Started in 1922, it is also the oldest. Each year, they sponsor more than 1,000 first American artists from more than 100 tribal communities in North America and Canada, generating more than $160 million annually in revenues for artists and the community. Of the six Chickasaw artists, three were participants and three chose to enter the competition, each competition entry placed, one receiving Best in Show. Daniel Worcester. This was Daniel Worcester's 32nd year at SWAIA. During the past three decades, Worcester has accumulated eight first-place ribbons and was awarded the Challenge Award in 1999, the only year it was given. That special award was for an artist who was challenging the traditional concepts of art in their material or medium. This year, due to scheduling, he decided to attend as a participant. Worcester is an accomplished bladesmith who incorporates his Chickasaw culture into every unique design he creates. I feel I am in tune with the land, the animals, nature. I like to bask in nature and let that flow into my work, he said. Being Chickasaw gives a real appreciation for the land and your surroundings and the people. I like that I can connect with nature, art, and with people. After 32 years at SWAIA, Worcester is still encouraging younger or even older artists to apply. Even though they might be scared to take that chance, it is worth it. As a Chickasaw artist, it gives me great pride that I am out here and my work is being accepted by people internationally who want to collect my work, Worcester said. These are the types of doors that an event like SWAIA can open for artists. Lisa Hudson. Lisa Hudson has always been fascinated with photography, but she didn't seriously pursue it until she was at Chickasaw Cultural Center working at the JULISO, the Center for Study of Chickasaw History and Culture. During her time there, she was inspired to capture the scenes and the people. She started experimenting with color and imagery and developed a unique style all her own. SWAIA is a special place for her. She went as a market participant this year and enjoyed meeting people and learning about others' art. The thing I enjoy most about SWAIA is the vast array of people you meet. You meet artists and visitors from all walks of life and from all over, Hudson said. While each participant and tribe is unique, we all have a shared spirit that makes SWAIA a very special place. Her experimentation with color and imagery is clearly seen in one of her recent pieces, Innocence, which depicts her grandson, Oliver. I love how it captures the spirit of youth, a canvas untarnished with the endless possibilities of life ahead, she said. Tyson Hudson. Tyson Hudson, Lisa Hudson's son, first started painting when he was in college. He was pursuing a degree in graphic design, but fell in love with painting. He particularly enjoys going to SWAIA because of the scale and high level of the art market. SWAIA is the highlight of the year for me and many other artists. It is a unique experience, and I always enjoy displaying my art for the large crowds and hearing the feedback, Hudson said. He is inspired by his Chickasaw heritage as well as artists from all different periods, especially Monet. I incorporate our heritage in my art by sharing my love and respect for nature and my local wildlife, he said. Our ancestors shared this land with the animals that inhabit it, and I try to represent that beauty of our relationship with the wildlife. In addition to depicting nature and people's relationship to it, Hudson is also interested in the relationship with oneself, as seen in one of his more recent paintings, Faded Gray, where he focuses on solitude and introspection. Melissa Freeman. This was Melissa Freeman's first year to enter SWAIA. The past few years, she attended the Southeastern Art Show and Market, the Artisan Arts Festival, and Hustola, and those experiences gave her the confidence to enter SWAIA this year. She was glad she did, especially when she received the second place ribbon in textiles for her dress, Dark Morning. Freeman created Dark Morning over the course of a month, working on it for 12 to 16 hours every day. It is a dedication to my father, created through fabric, beads, and thread. I often call it my morning dress, Freeman said. Before my father passed, I was overcome with a sadness I could not shake. This feeling propelled me to create this piece. Freeman's work is a personal representation of her own lived experiences, but it also expresses and pays homage to her Chickasaw and Choctaw identity. She likes to incorporate the culture of Chickasaw and Choctaw people into her work, and she is proud to share her creations at a venue as vast as SWAIA. I'm representing my ancestors who walked before me, who made sacrifices and endured to afford me the opportunity to create art to share with all, Freeman said. Addison Carl. Addison Carl had never been to SWAIA before. Though he submitted his application, he was not selected for it this year, but was put on a waiting list. In July, he was contacted to participate officially, and his Mississippian period effigies won the first place ribbon in glass sculpture. The Mississippian period effigies were originally inspired by a conversation with Brent Greenwood about the exhibition Visual Voices, where he saw two original ceramic effigies. Addison wanted to combine bronze and glass to create a vessel that was influenced by their originals. Addison said he was proud of finding the balance between bronze casting and glass casting and having these two worlds for all their similarities and then their major differences clash together to create something. His Chickasaw heritage informs his art in many ways, between the aesthetics, language, storytelling, and the influence of his grandfather, who Addison said had the largest impact on him. Most of it I didn't understand through the eyes of a child or young adult. Now mostly what I create begins with a memory or connection with him, he said. Regina Free. This was Regina Free's first year at SWAIA, and she was thrilled just to be accepted into the competition with her sculpture Windswept. As the event progressed, her excitement grew exponentially as she was presented the first place ribbon in sculpture and then, much to her surprise, awarded Best in Show. Windswept depicts the head of a bison looking directly at the spectator. It is made of many materials, including clay, plaster, metal sheeting, and paper towels. The variety of materials allows Free to capture the texture of the fur in a unique and realistic manner. Free's Chickasaw heritage is present in her choice of subjects, primarily animals, but also in the reverence and respect she feels for them. I try my hardest to have the spirit of the animal come through in what I'm doing, Free said. I try to leave a little drop of soul in everything I do. You can tell when a thing has soul in it or not. Up next, Building Pathways for Indigenous Public Health Leadership, Dr. PH and MPH Programs to Expand on Institute Course Offerings by Johns Hopkins Center for Indigenous Health. The nation's first Indigenous-focused Doctor of Public Health, DRPH, and corresponding Indigenous concentration in the Master of Public Health, MPH, program will open for applications in 2026 at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. These groundbreaking graduate programs offered through the Johns Hopkins Center for Indigenous Health will prepare future leaders to address the health priorities of Indigenous peoples through culturally informed, community-driven solutions. The Bloomberg School's Center for Indigenous Health has trained over 4,000 Indigenous scholars representing more than 50 tribal communities since the inception of its training program more than two decades ago. Its popular week-long online graduate courses, offered annually as summer and winter institutes, offer learners of all backgrounds opportunities to enhance their skills, whether taken for non-credit learning or for academic credit. Credit courses can be counted toward MPH and Dr. PH programs, as well as the Public Health Training Certificate for American Indian Health Professionals. Faye McMillan, DHSC, MIH, MCSCL, the center's Director of Education and Training, is Wiradjuri, the largest Aboriginal group in central New South Wales, Australia. She works hand-in-hand with Donald Warren, MD, MPH, the center's co-director, director of the center's Great Plains Hub in South Dakota, and a member of the Ogallala Lakota tribe to develop the forthcoming graduate programs while continuing to oversee institute courses. I keep hearing the words love and joy used in our learning, which blends Indigenous worldviews with Western public health methodologies so that students walk away with real-world applications, said Dr. McMillan. This year's Winter Institute, open for registration now through December 30th, includes two courses, an interdisciplinary approach to understanding the health of American Indians, introduces public health through an Indigenous lens, making it an excellent starting point for those new to the content. The dates are January 5th through 9th. Indigenous Harm Reduction examines harm reduction approaches and lived examples of harm reduction work happening within Indigenous contexts. Dates January 12th through 16th. Courses follow a condensed week-long format guided by leading experts in Indigenous health. Learners get access to guest lecturers, small group activities, and opportunities for building relationships and peer networks. Students often remark that institutes feel more like an immersion experience than a typical academic course, said Dr. McMillan. No one is here by accident. We remind students of this throughout our institute courses. JHCIH's education programs cultivate community and culturally grounded leadership. As the reputation of the institutes has grown over the years, so has their reach. I'm always excited by the backgrounds of students who participate, whether it's health, social justice, climate, education, said Dr. McMillan. The center's courses bring together Indigenous students and allies from across the world, benefiting from a wide variety of lived experiences and professional knowledges. Facilitators prioritize gathering and incorporating feedback from participants to ensure the learning environment is responsive. The institute was beautiful and inspiring, said Brooke Betsui, Navajo, about her winter 2025 experience. It taught me to leverage my cultural teachings and beliefs to build resilience and lasting public health programs for Indigenous communities. The stories shared by Indigenous faculty encourage students like me to succeed in higher education and professional realms. The journey to launching the nation's first Indigenous Health Dr. PH program. When Dr. Warren joined the center as co-director in 2022, he supercharged a long-held vision, creating a pathway for students to complete a doctorate in public health, Dr. PH, in Indigenous health. Among the most advanced professional qualifications in public health, the Dr. PH program will prepare early to mid-career public health officials to excel in leadership roles focused on the health of Indigenous people. The Dr. PH program will begin accepting applicants in 2026 alongside a Master of Public Health with an Indigenous concentration, both focused on Indigenous-led solutions. This innovative Dr. PH in Indigenous health, the first of its kind in the world, will equip public health professionals to strengthen Indigenous communities by leading change and shaping policy at the highest levels, said Dr. Warren. For more information, Dr. PH and MPH programs, contact Dr. Faye McMillan at fmmcmill1@jh.edu. Winter Institute courses can be found at their website, www.cih.jhu.edu. You're listening to Native Sun on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I am your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Up next, from the Arizona Republic, Klamath River's Resurgence Continues by Deborah Utasia Kroll. 1 year after the final piece of concrete was removed from the last of four dams on the Klamath River in Northern California, tribes and environmentalists say the river, the fish, and other species that depend on the Klamath's health are recovering, and tribes continue to reclaim their lands and waters. Barry McCovey, Yurok Tribe's fisheries director, said during a news conference on October 9th that the river is much clearer than it used to be. "We fish with gill nets, and a lot of times it becomes very difficult to fish when there's a lot of suspended algae fouling the nets," McCovey said. "But now people's ability to catch fish was much improved." Taz Soto, fisheries program manager for the Karuk tribe, said that the consortium carefully monitored water conditions in the weeks after the last dam came down, as silty water flowed through the banks. The tribe's real-time water quality monitors found that after the large rush of water once held behind the dams had passed, water quality greatly improved and continues to be good. "Water also is cooler now that artificially heated water flowing from the dams has ceased, which is optimal for salmon health." Damon Goodman, Mount Shasta Klamath Regional Director for California Trout, said the groups involved in river restoration are learning what salmon are teaching people about dam removal. "Almost instantly after the dam removal, their fish returned in greater numbers than I expected, and maybe anyone expected," he said. "After the first fall, Chinook salmon were spotted in Jenny Creek," he said, "and a consortium of tribes, environmentalists, and state wildlife officials documented about 7,700 Chinook migrating upstream from October 21st through December 28th, 2024, about 558 a day. And what the fish have shown us is something extraordinary," Goodman said. "The river seemed to come alive. A river once near death resuscitated." The Klamath River suffered through more than 100 years of mismanagement and injustices against tribal communities. Dams were built over ancestral Shasta Nation lands. The Upper Klamath Basin was replumbed for agriculture. Upstream from Upper Klamath Lake, a key tributary was channeled and wetlands drained, resulting in massive amounts of phosphorus flowing into the Upper Klamath Lake and eventually the lower river. As the flood of algae coursed downriver, it coalesced in the reservoirs behind the dams, which once had supplied electricity to the region before they were decommissioned. The rush of algae and the shallow waters of Iron Gate and Copco reservoirs created nurseries for even more algae to grow, and the river downstream was literally poisoned. These and other shocks to the Klamath River Basin's ancient ecosystem almost killed the river, the fish, and the people who rely on the river for sustenance and ceremony. After a catastrophic fish kill in 2002 caused by toxic algae released from the upstream reservoirs, tribes, environmentalists, and their allies acted, supported by the California and Oregon Wildlife Agency science reports on river and fish health. After a 20-year struggle, the four dams' owner finally agreed to remove the dams. The last coffer holding back water was breached in August of 2024. "Watching fish make it through a dam is pretty cool. Salmon continue to migrate upstream past where they were once stymied by the four dams for more than a century. Chinook salmon were spotted September 24th using a fish ladder to traverse the Keno Dam about 43 miles northeast of where the Copco Dam once impeded their migration. The Klamath tribes, whose traditional lands encompass the headwaters of the river and several tributaries, celebrated October 7th when fall Chinook salmon were spotted at the Link River Dam, about 15 miles upstream from the Kino Dam for the first time in more than 100 years. The Link River Dam is the final barrier before reaching Upper Klamath Lake. It was a pretty incredible thing to witness, said Mark Hereford, Klamath Fisheries Reintroduction Project Leader for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. The state and U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, which operates the dam, partnered to install video cameras to monitor the fish movements at the fish ladder. Just observing fish right before the dam and then looking at the fish getting through the dam was pretty cool. Other species also seem happy that the river is growing healthy. Beavers are returning to the Kopko Valley and Beaver Creek, Soto said. Bears, bald eagles, ospreys, and other such species have more food, said John Oberholzer of the Kurok tribe. It goes all the way up the food chain, and we're going to see the entire ecosystem get more nutrients from those salmon that are coming upriver, he said. That includes the tiniest species, McCovey said, minuscule invertebrates, which are key parts of the food web for the river, are doing well. We've been studying these bugs that lie at the bottom of the river, and they're a really good indicator of the river health, he said. Best of all, everyone at the meeting agreed, the river no longer stinks. Shasta Indian Nation, the rocks popping from the river, hitting them, make us happy. For the Shasta Indian Nation, removing the dams meant reclaiming the lands the reservoirs had drowned. In June, California Governor Gavin Newsom announced that the state would restore 2,800 acres of the ancestral homeland to the 300-member tribe. That land included two of the most culturally important parcels. The tribe also got the old powerhouse, which it is turning into a cultural center. Many of us feel we can carry a generational responsibility to the land and to the water, said Sammy Joe DeFontorum, Shasta Indian Nation's Cultural Preservation Officer. This particular area holds the stories of our ancestors. She said that when she first saw the landscape after the reservoir had drained, it was stark and barren. Nothing had grown there for about 100 years. But when DeFontorum heard the water coursing through its old path in her ancestral community, the rocks popping from the river made us happy. It meant the earth was starting to heal. It meant the river was starting to heal. And ultimately, our people were starting to heal. The land returns to its former lushness. The tribe is reclaiming other parts of its heritage. She said the people are implementing traditional ecological knowledge and stewardship. They're also working on revegetation, building food sovereignty programs, monitoring cultural sites, and restoring tributaries like Jenny Creek. And the tribe has revived something they had longed for, ceremonies. We held the salmon calling ceremony for the first time in 100 years, DeFontorum said. The work continues even as federal funding dries up. Some of the Klamath's other principal tributaries and key salmon nurseries were guaranteed minimum flows thanks to a bill signed by Newsom in September. Assembly Bill 263 requires maintaining river flows for at-risk salmon runs on the Scott and Shasta Rivers. Tribes and environmentalists hailed the progress and said more work is underway. Tributary restoration work continues, while replacing and monitoring plant growth is still underway. The Upper Klamath Basin is undergoing projects including rotating wetlands and crops along the lake and restoring the Klamath tribe's important fish. Soto said an even more important salmon run needs attention. The spring wild run Chinook population is less than 1,000 fish, he said, although a hatchery on the Trinity River provides spring Chinook, the wild fish are on the verge of extinction. But there's optimism that we can recover the spring Chinook now that we have the headwaters on the Klamath River. They're also concerned that the federal government is stalling and even calling into question funding and policy support for continued restoration work. That includes several federal grants to monitor and count fish populations on the Klamath and conduct restoration projects that were abruptly canceled in late September as part of an Interior Department directive slashing $14 million from the 79 groups that had indicated or still indicate they honor diversity, equity, and inclusion. All seven of Caltrout's grants were abruptly terminated, and including its salmon monitoring program, which was slashed with no explanation. Federal grants for the Mid-Klamath Watershed Council, based in Karuk Islands, were also slashed with no notice or reason why. The community-based nonprofit conducts forest and watershed restoration, community stewardship training, and coordinates with both tribal and non-tribal communities to prevent and mitigate wildfires along the river. Goodman said the project to monitor the fish is only at its beginning, and losing funding for scientific data collection on the world's largest restoration project was a setback. This data is crucial to help regulators make information decisions about watersheds and fisheries, Goodman said. While we're already seeing that the Klamath Dam removal was a success, we need consistent and accurate data to understand how much of a success this project was. He said that Caltrout was fundraising to fill the gap for the lost grants. But there's also good news. Naysayers who claim that the salmon couldn't make it past some waterfalls in the old dam areas were proven wrong when the fish sailed up the ripples as they had for millennia before the dam stopped them. And even as the federal government pulls funding and support back, the groups restoring the ancestral homes say they won't give up their efforts until the entire basin is restored to health. As we move forward, we'll learn more and more about the pieces of this puzzle, McCovey said. He said that the Klamath's success meant that a major landscape-scale restoration project is possible and can serve as a model for other such projects. And you know who else is liking the river after the dams? Shasta people, Differentorum said. I've spotted a few in the area. Up next, California Indian Nations College sees record enrollment and expands its cultural and academic impact. From Native News Online, Palm Desert, California. California Indian Nations College, CINC, SINC, the only accredited tribal college in California in decades, is experiencing remarkable growth while making a profound impact on Indigenous education. Since its founding, SINC has served 506 students, providing culturally responsive higher education that empowers Native communities and fosters leadership, academic success, and cultural preservation. Enrollment continues to climb, reaching 141 students in fall 2024 and 151 students in spring 2025, with 82.3% of spring 2025 students identifying as American Indian or Alaskan Native. This record-breaking enrollment underscores the demand for a college that centers Indigenous identity while offering rigorous academic programs tailored to first-generation and non-traditional learners. A diverse and inclusive student body. SINC serves as an educational home for Indigenous students and allies, offering a unique environment where culture, identity, and academic rigor intersect. In spring 2025, the student population is predominantly American Indian, Alaskan Native at 82.3%. The college is a beacon for first-generation students. 76.4% of SINC students are first in their family to attend college. With an average age of 34, SINC accommodates working adults, parents, and other non-traditional learners, demonstrating flexibility and a commitment to serving students with diverse life circumstances. Supporting access and equity, 100% of undergraduates receive financial aid, ensuring that underserved communities have the opportunity to pursue higher education. Gender equity is also central to the college's mission. 83% of degrees awarded last year went to women, highlighting SINC's role in fostering Indigenous female leadership. Accreditation and growth. SINC recently achieved eligibility to apply for candidacy status in its accreditation journey, a significant milestone that signals national recognition and opens doors to federal funding, academic partnerships, and enhanced student opportunities. the step cements SYNC's position as a leader in Indigenous higher education and underscores its commitment to academic excellence. You've been listening to Native Sun on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I am your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Join us next time for an upcoming episode. Music is Land Back by Hallucination.